you don't know me, my name is Esther Mann, and today I'm talking on Deborah, Judge, Prophetess, and Military Advisor.
Nice map.
We've already looked at in this series at Eve and then at Sarah and Hagar. Now we're moving on into the period of the judges. And just to review quickly the history, to get fresh in our minds so we know what time period we're in, what's happened is the sons of Israel, or Jacob, have gone down to Egypt because of the famine. And they've lived there, eventually becoming enslaved. And it takes a liberator, Moses, called by God to bring them out of Egypt in the Exodus. And then there's the famous story, of course, of wandering in the wilderness to Sinai, where they received the covenant at Sinai. And then, after wandering around for 40 years or so, they come on up to the east here of the Jordan River. And after Moses dies, Joshua leads the people in to the conquest of the promised land, the land of Canaan here. In the book of Joshua, the conquest is speedy and total. The Israelites just move in, and the 12 tribes settle, and all the peoples are wiped out. It's kind of an idealistic picture of the way things happen, because when we go to the book of Judges, which follows Joshua, we learn that actually a number of indigenous peoples, people who had lived there before the Israelites, remained, and that it was a long period of battles and so forth before there was actually control of the area by the Israelites. In the book of Judges, we have stories of a number of judges and just mention of some judges' names. There's about 13 judges that are listed, and Deborah is the only female judge, so naturally we'll concentrate on her. The pattern that unites all the stories of the judges is a simple one, and it is given in the very early part of the book of Judges in chapter 2, basically. And that is, this historical pattern is that as long as the people of Israel do the right thing and worship the right God in the land of Canaan, everything goes great. The land is at peace. There's prosperity. But as soon as the people begin to worship other gods, which would have been sort of natural when you come into a new land with new customs, and the introduction of a new economy based on agriculture, when they started to worship the gods that were associated with this new lifestyle, then that's when the problems started. And then God would give them over into the hands of one of these peoples that was still around, for example, the Philistines or the Canaanites or a number of other peoples. And so the Israelite tribes then would experience a period of war. And then they would remember, oh yeah, we have a God that saves us. So then they would pray, and then a deliverer would be raised up. A deliverer or a savior would be raised up, and these were the judges. So this is the pattern, the historical pattern that unites all of the different stories of the judges. The judges apparently were local charismatic leaders from different tribes, usually gives the name of the tribe. And it's just this pattern that unites them all. Okay, with that, let's start looking at the first version of the story of Deborah, and that's a prose account in chapter 4 of Judges. It's interesting, there's two accounts, the prose account in chapter 4 and the poetic account in chapter 5. The poetic account is actually the older account. Maybe even it had its composition right after the event as a kind of way to publish the event. And it seems to have been written by a woman, or at least from a woman's point of view. Very interesting. The prose account is later, and I think it shows a masculine point of view. But we'll start out with the prose because it does give a sort of a straight story. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. Ehud was the judge before. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Yabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt in Hareshet Hagoyim, Then the people of Israel cried to the Lord for help, for he had 900 chariots of iron and oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Okay, so here we have the pattern, right? The old judge dies, and they forget what they're all about, and so the Lord sells them into the hand of Yabin, king of Hazor, which is a Canaanite city. The Canaanites were a very strong presence. They lived in walled cities, big walled cities, mostly in the fertile level areas. They were an agricultural society, and they had very advanced technology. As we see, they had 900 chariots of iron. This is like the stealth bomber today or something like that back in that time, you know. We're talking about high technology. That's why they're mentioning it here. He had a commander whose name is Sisera, and that's important because Sisera is really the main enemy that the Israelite tribes meet, and he's stationed over here in a Hareshet Hagoyim, which is on this little river, the Kishon River, which isn't much of a river, but there it is, here in the Galilee region. One thing that's interesting, just as a side note, to point out the contrast between the book of Joshua and the book of Judges. In the book of Joshua, the king of King Yabin is completely annihilated already. So here we meet him again. So you can tell that the story in Joshua is a highly idealized story, sort of like how it should have happened, you know. But anyway, there he is. Now we're going to meet Deborah. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidot, was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Beth-El in the hill country of Ephraim. And the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. All right, let's meet Deborah. Deborah means bee, so she was a queen bee. She lived down here. It calls her, now Deborah, a prophetess. In Hebrew, it actually says, now Deborah, a woman, a prophetess. It's almost like, wow, a woman, a prophetess. Although women prophets are not that rare, actually. There are a number of them. There's a woman named Huldah in the 7th century during the reign of Josiah, who's called on to interpret some texts that are found in the temple, and it leads to a very important reform of the temple. So there are prophetesses, actually. But this text, which is a male-written text, seems to be a surprise. It goes, a woman, a prophetess. Your translation probably just leaves off woman, because they probably think it's redundant. But I think it's important, because it shows that it's a text that's showing surprise. A lady? A lady prophetess. Right, now Deborah, a lady prophetess. And then it says, the wife of Lapidot. This is really, who is Mr. Lapidot? Does anyone know who Mr. Lapidot is? We don't know who Mr. Lapidot is. He doesn't show up in any stories. And in fact, it's really odd. There's two ways of translating this phrase that I don't know if some of you were here when during the time when we were discussing Eve, but the woman for, the name for woman, or the word for woman in Hebrew is Isha. And it's the same woman, if I could speak, it's the same word as the word for wife. So Isha means wife or woman. There's no difference at all. So there's two ways of translating this phrase. One is the wife of Lapidot. The other is woman of Lapidot. Now what is Lapidot? Lapid is a torch or a flame. Lapidot is a feminine plural of that, which means so torches. So it could mean a woman of fire, a flashy kind of woman, a woman with a lot of, you know, boiling spirit, Sparky, maybe was her nickname, something like that. But almost, I bet all your translations say a wife of Lapidot, right? Okay, but I would translate it. Now Deborah, a woman prophetess, a woman of, you know, inspiration, flashes, was judging at that time. And then it gives where she was sitting. She even had a place, and everybody knew where she was. She was down here between Bethel and Ramah, under a palm tree. It's like in the Peanuts comic strip, right? The doctor is in. And people would come up for judgment. Now this is interesting. She is the only judge in the book of Judges that actually does any judging. All the others are military leaders. That's their primary role. In fact, none of the other judges ever do anything except lead men into battle. So here we have the real thing, I think, except that most commentators who happen to be male say that she wasn't really a judge. because she didn't lead the men into, she wasn't a military leader, because all the other judges were military leaders. So this is kind of problematic, because you have a person, Deborah, who's actually judging, ruling, you know, giving judgments, but she's excluded because she's not like all the others. Very strange. Anyway, that's a little bit of it about the history of scholarship, too, about Deborah. So now we come into the part of the story that talks about the military project here. She sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kedesh in Naphtali, and said to him, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go gather your men in Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the tribe of Naphtali and the tribe of Zebulun. And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Yabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." All right, so she summons Barak from Kedesh. Now, I have to mention one other possible interpretation of Wife of Lapidot, and that is that Lapidot was a nickname for Barak, because Barak's name means lightning. So some people have said that actually, you know, Wife of Lapidot, she's talking about Barak. If that's the case, we have the first commuter marriage here, too. It's a good 100 miles. And that was not easy in that day. So I don't think that she's the wife of Barak. They never had, anyway. She calls him, and he comes down to her. So she summons him. Now, this is interesting. In the Old Testament period, before anyone would go to battle, you needed to consult a prophet, a prophetess in this case. It wasn't a matter of taking account of your army and deciding, well, are we strategically able to do this? You might do that also, but you needed the word, the go-ahead of the God. And so how would you know what was going to happen, what your God was going to do, how the battle was going to be decided? You need a prophet to tell you. And so here we have an example of Deborah acting as a prophetess in this case. And notice, he's supposed to come up here to Mount Tabor right here, gather the troops from Naphtali. This is the tribe of Naphtali right here. And this is Zebulun right here. And they're supposed to gather right here and get ready to meet Sisera. And it says, the Lord will draw Sisera out and do battle. So it's not even the troops that are doing battle. This is an example of the concept of the holy war. God does the fighting and leads the troops. The troops just kind of walk in after and clean up, basically. And we'll see that especially stressed in the poem, this whole concept of the holy war. Barak said to her, "If you will not go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." And she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kedesh. And Barak summoned Zebulun and Naphtali to Kedesh, and 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went with him. So she goes up here, and they summon the troops. And before she goes, though, she says, "But watch out, a woman will take the honor." Which kind of makes you think, okay, Deborah's going along. She's there, so it kind of makes you think, oh, okay, we know who's going to get the victory. But there's a kind of a neat subplot, and actually a very interesting character. I would have worked her into the title of my talk, Yael, but I didn't know exactly how to fit that all in one line. Now we have a little aside that sets the scene here. Now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Za'anamnim, which is near Kedesh. So we have a little aside. It doesn't develop it at all. But Moses' father-in-law, according to one tradition, was a Kenite. According to another tradition, he was a Midianite. But anyway, there were people who lived way down in the south here, and apparently one group had moved up and was living up here. So this becomes important later. It doesn't develop that here. All right, the story continues. When Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with them, from Hareshet Hagoyim to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all the army before Barak at the edge of the sword. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Hereshet Hagoyim. And all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. So here we have the battle scene in this prose account here. All of Sisera's men are called out here. And notice, it's once again, it's Deborah who's saying, you know, what day the battle is going to be fought. She's acting as the prophetess. This is the day that the Lord will give the enemy into your hand. And notice that it says the Lord routed Sisera. So the holy war concept. God's doing all the work. People are just mopping up here. And then Sisera gets down and goes on foot. So the great army officer, the one who has these 900, you know, stealth bombers in that day, the iron, which the Israelites did not have, he gets down and walks as a normal person and flees. And Barak pursues, you know, the big equipment and so forth. But Sisera goes up here instead and is escaping. Now this is one of the most interesting sections here that's coming up, because this is the story of what happens to Sisera after he flees as an ordinary person on foot instead of in his chariots. But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Yael, and Yael's name means antelope, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Yabin the king of Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Yael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, have no fear." So he turned aside to her tent, and she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, "Pray give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty." And she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say, 'No.'" But Yael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the tent peg into his temple till it went into the ground as he lay fast asleep.
Ooh, from weariness.
So he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Yael went out to meet him and said, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with a tent peg in his temple. So here we have it. Yael, the wife of Heber. Sisera runs up here, and he goes from the battle, from his place of power, into a woman's tent. He's alone with a woman there. And there he meets his death, which is exactly what Deborah had predicted. It's interesting, in this male version of the story, Yael is not quite, she's playing dirty, because she asks him in, she says, "Turn aside, my lord," and that in the context of the desert peoples, the nomadic tribes and so forth, that is an invitation, or that is an indication that you're going to give that person hospitality. And hospitality was a thing that was required of people who were living in the desert. Anyone who came up to your camp, enemy or friend, actually, you had to house them for, I think it's 2 nights, 3 days and 2 nights or something like that, whether they were your worst enemy or whether they were your best friend, because they had no hotels or anything. And if you're wandering in the wilderness, as we saw with Hagar and Ishmael, you're going to die in a matter of, you know, days. So that was just the law of the desert. And so in this male story, she's kind of tricky, actually. You know, she invites him in, and then she's deceitful. It's interesting that he's reduced. He's there in her tent, covered up with a rug, and even asking for such a little thing as, you know, water. "Can I have a little water?" So she gives him milk, which would have been in the tent. It would have been readily available there. And notice, she's acting as a mother here. So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him, like a little baby, and he falls asleep. So he's totally lost his power as a military leader there. And he asserts himself here. He says, "Stand by the door of the tent." So he's, you know, giving commands as he used to do. "And if anyone asks you, you know, is anybody here?" Say, "No." So he kind of reasserts his power. He tells her, "You know, do this." But actually, he's being a little predictive of his own death, because, "Is anyone here?" Say, "There is no Ain, there is none," which in Hebrew, that's, if you say Ain, that can also mean that someone has died. So in a way, he's being very truthful, you know. Or she's going to be able to say that with sincerity. And then she kills him while he's asleep. Now, when we read the poetic account, it's going to be very interesting, because here it almost makes excuses for Sisera. Why did he get himself into this mess? You know, how did he get a woman to, how did he allow himself to be killed by a woman? You know, well, she deceived him. She invited him in. There he was. And then he was sleeping. He was so tired. And some people have even, male interpreters have even said, you know, well, the milk she gave him, it was, it made him sleep, or she mixed it with wine, or there's all kinds of funny things with them. They're trying to make excuses. Why is this great general, you know, killed by a woman? It's such a shameful thing. So you can see that even though it's an enemy male, the male psyche who's writing, you know, this is trying to kind of defend and cover up, you know, how a great general would fall by a woman's hand. And then the story ends up with Barak coming in and Barak's shame, you know, seeing, oh, you know, I was supposed to kill this guy, but he was killed by a woman. Okay, so this is the male version here, and it basically ends up by saying, so on that day, God subdued Yabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel, and the hand of the people of Israel bore harder and harder on Yabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Yabin, the king of Canaan. So, success story. Are there any questions or comments before we continue to the poetic account?
Where does it indicate that Barak got bad?
Well, just at the beginning, where she says to Barak in 9, Barak says, you know, go with me. If you go with me, I'll go. If you don't go, then I won't go. And she says, okay, I'll go with you, but the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory. For the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. Now, this was a disgraceful thing. And actually, you can see it from extra-biblical sources, too. They're later, so you know, you wonder how you can compare. But in some pre-Islamic Arabic women's poetry, one thing the women do to get the men to go into, to take blood vengeance, the men that are reluctant, you know, they don't want to go on and kill somebody, I mean, for crying out loud, and, you know, get in danger and stuff like that. The women will compare the men to women. And, you know, it's just a disgraceful thing to be killed by a woman, because women, you know, they're supposed to be weak and ineffectual and so forth, and so it would have been embarrassing. So no, it doesn't say, you know, Barak was embarrassed, but the whole story ends up, you know, it starts out by her saying, you're not going to get any glory, it's going to fall into a hand of a woman, and then the last thing we see, the conclusion is Barak goes in and sees the man killed and the woman's there. She shows him, look, you know, the one you're looking
pretty
for.
Pretty good glory that he knocked off those other chariots.
Right, yeah, that's true. But she got the big one. Yeah, but the way this, you're right, I'm sure he had his hands pretty bloody too, but the way the story is set up at the beginning, you know, she says, you're not going to get the glory a woman is, and at the end, a woman shows him, look, the man you were looking for to kill, he's already dead. I did it. Uh-huh.
Yeah, two questions, Pastor. One, you said that Deborah is the only one who actually judges. Of the judges, are there other people who did that job that she was doing? Mm-hmm.
You know, the judges might have done it,
yeah,
too. Actually, it just doesn't describe it more fully. And in fact, probably the other judges did, because there's stories of this one judge and his 30 sons going around on 30 donkeys. A donkey was a royal animal. And so they kind of had a circuit, but it never describes the people coming to them for judgment. So it's really was that sentence more. But the word itself, shafat, to judge, implies that they were acting as rulers, but that there was no separation really between the military leadership and between a more, you know, legal kind of or other responsibilities of a ruler. So probably the others were ruling, but this is the only one that makes it explicit.
Yeah. And is it unusual that the judge would call the general and say, come to me, rather than the general say to the prophet, come to me?
Yeah, it's very unusual. If you look at the time of the kings, it was always the king that would call the prophet, mm-hmm, for advice, so that the king was consulting his cabinet, basically. But in this case, the judges are seen as charismatic leaders who make things happen. And so I think that she's acting in that sense. And
so she's really the one who sets up the battle.
Right. And some commentators, you know, when they disqualify her, say, well, she wasn't really a judge. She's kind of an ambiguous figure, you know, whatever. They say because she didn't lead the actual battle, Barak is actually, you know, the one who's acting as a military leader. And it's interesting, if you look in Hebrews 11, I don't know what verse, I think it's 32 or something. This is a list of all the people who lived by faith. Faith is hope for things unseen. And it recounts, you know, Abraham left his homeland not knowing what he was getting into, blah, blah, blah. And talks about all these different by faith, people who did things by faith. In 32 then, it's 11:32. What more shall I say? Going on and on. For a time would fail me to tell of, and then here's the list of judges, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, received promises, stopped the mouths of lions, and so forth. He goes on and on and on. But Barak is the one who's mentioned from the story. So that apparently was an early judgment. Deborah can't be a judge because she doesn't actually lead the battle. She calls Barak. Barak is the judge. So it's interesting how you have the disqualification of a woman who, even in the male version here in Judges, is clearly, you know, she's a lady prophetess, who's judging. They go to some length to describe what she's doing, maybe to clarify, you know, to emphasize, this is really true. There really was somebody like this. Okay, any other questions? All right, now let's look at this poem in chapter 5. This is perhaps the oldest poem in the Hebrew Bible. The period of the Judges, most people think, started around 1250 or so BC. And this poem might have been composed sometime in the 12th century, sometime in the 1100s, maybe around the same time. And we'll see that it was, in the poem itself, it specifies that the story should be told, and this is one way that the story was told. Okay, it says, then sang Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, on that day, that the leaders took lead in Israel, that the people offered themselves willingly, bless the Lord. So it's a little dedication of the whole poem here to those who fought in battle, but the leaders and the people. One thing I should say is, before we begin on this poem, it is a very old poem, and it has a lot of archaic features. And now, what it means when people say it has a lot of archaic features is that nobody knows how to translate it, really. So if your version is quite different, and I think the New Revised Standard Version is quite different, don't be too surprised. People don't know what to make of some of the language. I was using the New Revised Standard Version this morning. It was the first time I was reading it through, and I was just reading it, I thought, this would be kind of neat to read this, and other people will read the Revised Standard. It is so different. But anyway, okay, so this is a little introduction, dedication to the people who fought the war. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes, to the Lord I will sing. I will make melody to the Lord, the God of Israel. So once again, a little intro to the purpose of the poem or the song. The song that's sung by Deborah and Barak, it says. Although it's interesting, later, Deborah in 12, it's Deborah that is the one who's called to sing a song. And actually the verb in verse 5, in 5:1, when it says, then sang Deborah and Barak, is a feminine verb. So it's Deborah saying it's a feminine verb. One thing you're going to notice in this poem is something that you see a lot of in Hebrew poetry, and that is parallelism. In Hebrew poetry, the Hebrew poet likes to repeat him or herself. So you have, hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. To the Lord I will sing. I will make melody to the Lord, the God of Israel. And you're going to find that throughout, that kind of repetition. That's considered very elevated style in Hebrew poetry. We might think this is sort of repetitious, right? But that was very high style. So you'll see that throughout this poem. And if you read the Psalms, you'll see it too. Okay, so now we've had the introduction, a little introduction here, and notice in this next section, we're going directly into this image of the holy war, of God leading the people, actually not even in this section, not even leading the people, just coming out and doing the battle, marching through and doing battle himself. Lord, when thou didst go forth from Seir, when thou didst march from the region of Edom, the earth trembled, and the heavens dropped, yea, the clouds dropped water, the mountains quaked before the Lord, Yon Sinai before the Lord, the God of Israel. So God is seen, this is interesting in some of the Psalms too, God is seen as a desert God coming down here from Edom, and marching up, and everything's trembling and shaking, all the mountains, everything, you know, the clouds are raining, everything is just in awe, and he's going to come up and do battle. So it's a picture of war as God's action. Human beings actually just sort of fall, you know, happen to be there. And now it describes a little in more human terms after kind of telling what's going on in the divine sphere. In the days of Shamgar, that was another one of the judges, one who killed 600 people with an ox goad, son of Anat. In the days of Yael, our heroine, caravans ceased and travelers kept to the byways. The peasantry ceased in Israel. They ceased until you arose, Deborah, arose as a mother in Israel. When new gods were chosen, when war was in the gates, was shield or spear to be seen among 40,000 in Israel? My heart goes out to the commanders of Israel who offered themselves willingly among the people. Bless the Lord. So that repetition of bless the Lord. Okay, so this is describing a time when apparently there was a lot of conflict, chaos, attacks from, you know, the Canaanites, apparently, from the other story. Travelers couldn't travel on the roads anymore. The peasantry was having a hard time and so forth, until you arose. And here we have Deborah as the main character here, not Barak at all. Until you arose, Deborah, arose as a mother in Israel. So here we have Deborah being a mother. Aim. When we say in the Lord's Prayer here, Abba Ima, in Hebrew the word for father is Ab, and the word for mother is Aim. But, of course, children usually don't stop at just, you know, they don't say immediately father or mother, they say, you know, daddy and mommy. So Abba means daddy and Ima means mommy. So here she's seen as a mother. Now this is interesting because we usually hear about the Old Testament women, we usually hear that they were only valued for their ability to bear children and so forth. Well, it's interesting because all the matriarchs, the real tough stuff like Sarah and so forth, they were always barren. So they weren't valued for their ability to have children. They just happened to have children after they were already valued and, you know, their children were valued. And the same thing here, we never know anything about any of Deborah's children. Was she married? Maybe she was married to Mr. Lapido, we don't know. But in any event, we have no children. But she is a mother, she is a matriarch. It actually calls her an equivalent term to the patriarchs, to the Avraham, great dad, you know, Abraham. Here's a mother. Here's an example of what a matriarch does in Israel. Don't ask me what the next part of that section that we just read means. I do not know. But anyway, it goes out to the final thing, you know, once again, recognizes the people that took place in took part in the battle. Now, going on to 10 and 11. Tell of it, you who ride on tawny asses, you who sit on rich carpets, and you who walk by the way. To the sound of musicians at the watering places, there they repeat the triumphs of the Lord, the triumphs of his peasantry in Israel. So everyone should tell of this great event here, those who ride on tawny asses, once again the royal animal, and so forth. We're not going to read the whole next part here because after a little introduction, which says, then down to the gates march the people of the Lord. Awake, awake, Deborah, arise, awake, utter a song. Arise, Barak, lead away your captives, the son of Abinoam. So they're calling on Deborah and Barak. And then after this, they have a roll call of all the people who, all the different tribes that participated. So we'll skip over that. Some are commended more highly than others. It's kind of, you know, you get the purple heart, and then the others are scorned. There are three tribes, it says here. Asher, which is along here, Asher still sat at the coast of the sea, settling down by his landing. Dan, why did he abide with the ships? So they're blaming some people who didn't join in, too. So this is kind of the roll call, you know, who participated, who kind of finked out on people. Okay, now we have the actual description of the battle here in very poetic form in 19. The kings came, they fought, then fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. They got no spoils of silver, for from heaven fought the stars. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent Kishon swept them away, the onrushing torrent, the torrent Kishon. March on, my soul, with might. Then loud beat the horse's hooves with the galloping, galloping of his steeds. So the stars are fighting. Once again, this cosmic battle, and the river swells, and you have a flood. This imagery of a flood is very common to describe the destruction of armies. In the Bible and also in other ancient Near Eastern literature, armies come in as floods and just wash everything away in their course. So what's happening here is this river, it's a dinky little river, it poetically is described as flooding as the people are slaughtered. Okay. 23, another curse against another group of people apparently that didn't show up. Now we're to the interesting part here. Yael. How is Yael described in this? Most blessed of women be Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, of tent-dwelling women most blessed. He asked water, and she gave him milk. She brought him curds in a lordly bowl. She put her hand to the tent peg, and her right hand to the workman's mallet. She struck Sisera a blow. She crushed his head. She shattered, and she pierced his temple. He sank. He fell. He lay still at her feet. At her feet, he sank. He fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. Okay. She doesn't offer him any kind of hospitality that she goes back on. She's most blessed of all women. She gives him milk. And then she puts her hand to the tent peg. Remember, in poetry, you have parallelism. And her right hand to the workman's mallet. It's the same thing. She's just picking up her tool. And this would have been a tool she would be very familiar with, because in this culture, the women were the ones that put up the tents. So she's picking up, it's describing in poetic terms, and it's interesting, in the male version, she picks up both things. You know, she picks up two instruments and just kind of taps the peg into his head. But here she's picking up her tool, and notice she's crushing it. She's not just, you know, tapping the peg into his temple, so there, you know, it's lying in this, like a needle on the ground. She's taking it, and she's striking Sisera, she's crushing his head, she's shattering, you know. There's a real... The whole thing's like blowing up, and he's falling. So he must have been standing, right? He's not just sleeping, and she like creeps up, and you know that's how she's able to overcome him. But she's standing. He's falling. He sank. He fell. He lay still at her feet. At her feet, he sank. He fell. Repeats, you know, those action things. It's very nice. At her feet, she fell. That's sort of dainty, you know. At her feet, but actually in the Hebrew, it says bein regleha, between her legs. He fell between her legs, which it's interesting because you could say that that's where women have power over men, both at childbirth and sex. So she had him between her legs, down, completely at her mercy. So it really celebrates the power of, the special power of women over men in her capture or her destruction of him. And notice that she doesn't, then Barak doesn't rush in, and it's not all about Barak, how Barak is embarrassed. So it's not a male story at all. Instead, we continue to another place. We continue to the palace, to Sisera's mother's room. So the poem ends up with another women's view. 28. It says, out of the window she peered, the mother of Sisera gazed through the lattice. Why is this chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the hoofbeats of his chariots? Her wisest ladies make answer. Nay, she gives answer to herself. Are they not finding and dividing the spoil? A maiden or two for every man? Spoil of dyed stuffs for Sisera, spoil of dyed stuffs embroidered, 2 pieces of dyed work embroidered for my neck as spoil. So you have a vision of these women off waiting outside of the battle here. We know the result. It's kind of an interesting literary device. We already know. They're asking what's happened, what can be delaying them. And eventually Sisera's mother has to answer herself. She says, oh, they're probably dividing the spoil. So unlike Deborah, who's a prophetess, who knows you know, this is the day of battle, Barak, you're gonna not gain glory though, another woman will. So unlike Deborah, who knows what's happening, Sisera's mother's over here wondering what's happening. But it's kind of interesting, in the Hebrew it's a little, has a little more meaning, because she suggests a maiden or two for every man. In Hebrew it's basically, it says a womb or two for every head of a soldier. A womb or two for every head of a soldier, which can be translated this, a maid or two for every man. But when you think of a womb or two for every head of a man, it sort of recalls Deborah and Yael beating the soldier's head too. So in a way, Sisera's mother is sort of being is speaking the truth also. So it's more humorous and stronger, as well as being rather poignant, you know, the two women waiting. So these are Sisera's mother and her ladies waiting there. And so those women are contrasted in their waiting stance with the mother, you know, with the strong Deborah and Yael, the women of the Hebrews. Kind of interesting poem. And then just ends, so perish all thine enemies, O Lord, but thy friends be like the sun as he rises in his might. Does anybody have any questions or comments immediately about this, the poetic section?
I read in it that they had a flash flood. In verse 4, talking about the earth shook, the heavens poured, the clouds poured down water, which then would fit into saying, you know, sort of the stars did the battle, the river Kishon swept them away, which also could explain why their chariots were powerless if they had a flash flood in the desert. Then all their chariots for dry land were no good, and the Israelites may indeed have just kind of mopped up after the river rather than
out. Okay, yeah, that's one a good translation. So, you know, it could have been a flash flood or something like that. That's definitely a possibility. I would just, my own reaction to that is that when you look at the other literature from the ancient Near East, and you see that this flood imagery is used all the time, I mean, it's just always there. You know, the Assyrians come in like floods, like, you know, the black-headed people come in like a flood, like a torrent. They overcome all things in their path. It's just, it's cliche. It's, you know, it's...
But I mean, it sounds like the name did have had periodic floods.
Sure.
So when they said like a flood, because, I mean, they probably were not being flooded by the Mediterranean coming in to them. And I haven't been in the Southwest to be in flash floods in the Southwest. Mm-hmm. But what I've heard about them is that, you know, the land is so parched when they do get rain that it just all rolls off the top, and there are indeed great floods in very precise, you know, limited time periods.
Yeah, so I agree. There's two different ways of looking at this. One, you can say, yeah, it literally happened this way, which is what you're doing, and that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is saying, this is poetry, and it's expressing, you know, that it's expressing the fury of the battle or whatever. So maybe they're
also
not.
Also, doesn't that poetry, that recurring image, reflect the reality of the way floods do happen in that part of the country? So it's an image that people use and understand.
Yeah, that's true. Because it doesn't reflect reality.
Whether it was a flood, I mean, the imagery probably came because it was an occurrence that happened to people. The flooding was a recurring event, like tornadoes or something in Kansas. So.
Yeah, it was a natural disaster that they had a lot of experience with. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I do live where there are flash floods, and you can hear them coming, and it is like the roar of almost motorized units that we would think now, or a train coming, long before the water gets there. So it would be like an army roaring down upon them. So the imagery is really...
It's very strong.
Apt.
Strong imagery for this situation.
It reminds me, we were in Israel and on tour buses, and they don't build bridges much there. They just, even if the river got a little bit high, we were supposed to drive across it, and one tour bus went through, say, this much water, but by the time ours came, it was 18 inches. And there's no way that bus driver was going to drive on that road over all this water. It was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it, it really does happen in those climates, that's for sure. Let me ask you a question and then see if you have comments on this line of thought here. Often, there's a group of feminists who would argue that women are more nurturing and less warlike. And their argument would be that women should enter into all levels of power because then we would have a safer world. The world would be less liable to, you know, blow itself up or whatever. Stories such as this, which celebrate the military action of women such as Deborah and Yael, would suggest that that's not the case necessarily. So I would like to bring up the whole question of women and war. There are really interesting, a number of interesting examples of the interaction between male and female, even if the males are the ones who more often go into battle. Often women play a role in encouraging the men in a number of different ways. Just one specific example that I'm familiar with, it's from way back, but you know, we could probably have much more recent example, is exactly that pre-Islamic Arabic women's poetry, where the women make fun, well, they have poetry to incite the men to go and take blood vengeance, to rectify a situation of disharmony out between two different groups of people that can't be resolved within the group, within the moral setting of the group. So these women come and they taunt the men. They say, oh, you're just like women. You know, you have to go do this, blah, blah, blah. If you don't, you're a woman. And so they create a warrior. They create warriors who go out and really act immorally, according to the standards of the community, to resolve conflicts and to further the interests of the group. And that's just one specific example that I'm familiar with, but I'm curious about your reactions. What exactly is the relationship between women and war? Are women less warlike, more like the same? Or
if you're going to achieve liberation, you know, what better way is there than, I mean, she was using a woman's tuition, if you go by my theory, woman's tuition, flash flood is coming. The people run in with virtually no casualties on their side. I mean, they do rout the other people. But, I mean, if you've got to, your males have gone into battle, but they suffer virtually no casualties, I mean, how can you have a much more women's viewpoint than that scenario?
Other comments?
Mm-hmm. Well, in modern times with Golda Meir, just had a shorter war than the men, that's all. And Margaret Thatcher went into the fall.
Margaret Thatcher, exactly.
And so, you know, I think people who reach positions of leadership then do the things that's necessary in leadership. And when you look at her driving a tent peg in his head or bashing his head over with a mallet, now that can't be any really different when you look at it than cutting his head off with a sword if you're a man. Mm-hmm. You know, they're at war with each other. So I don't look at that as immoral on her part of it. Because, you know, I think the men are even worse when they circumcise that whole bunch of people. And then after 3 days, when they couldn't move, they went up and killed them all off. That was even more deceitful, I think, than men doing. But my own feeling is that out of the feminine, I don't know how you put it, femininity, or there is a compassion, it seems to me, of a person who is carrying another individual in their womb, and a love that that carries with women that men have to learn. And it does, I think it's more of a learned thing from them that comes some way out of the experience of women. But I just don't think myself that women by nature, they can all become warlike, but I don't think by nature they are in that same way pulling each other off, that they have more of a sense of continuing and nourishing and keeping the stuff alive than is natural men. Probably all that maleness, whatever it is,
that's just thank you.
Would you accept that perhaps women's aggression comes out of a protective position rather than one of just being the first to act?
Any reactions to that? comment? That's interesting.
I think women can be mighty cool when they have a goal, just like men. We have a goal in the river, like she said, protecting, and they can be pretty cool. No problem.
I've got a little more response to text, but this is usually disappointment. I kind of wish, because in my thinking, I wish that I'll endeavor would have solved this in a different way, but the whole setup is for a battle, and so that's the way, that's what they're in. They don't seem to be able to function in a different way, somehow reconcile this. The way I'd like it to be is that Deborah, and as a judge, settles this in some way, some negotiated peaceful settlement, because that's how women do things.
I know.
Never be that way, so I'm always discouraged.
That's why I like these texts, because, you know, kind of jolts you, then lets you.
You made something of this, that they call her a mother in Israel. And, you know, Al's point about maybe it's not just being a woman, but if you're a mother, maybe that's something different. It's curious to me. I don't know what the writer is after here, but it's really curious that they describe her as a mother. Maybe it's this point about protectiveness. And I'm not really sure where to go with it, but
exactly.
It's a fascinating thing that the matriarchs are all barren. Even into the New Testament, Elizabeth being barren. But then we get this one who's a warrior, and in a way, takes the edge off of it. Yeah, either it takes the edge off of it by saying, well, yeah, she was a warrior, but remember, she was also a mother.
Well, don't you think it's a status, a recognition of some kind of authority, or
maybe?
I don't know, because, see, nobody else has called this, a woman in Israel. You know, there's a mother of this.
What about the prophets about weeping?
A what?
Where it talks about the women in Judah weeping.
Like Rachel.
Rachel. Do they use that? They don't use the phrase.
I'll look it up afterwards. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Do you want to, either way?
Well, I think I do feel that probably all human beings have the potential for extreme love and kindness and all that, and extreme cruelty and getting their own way. And I think sometimes it's simply opportunity that is missing for some. And I think for many women, the opportunity was not there for warlike things. So I don't think I quite feel that by nature we are so much superior. I think we have to grow and develop just like anyone.
Historically, it seems like the when I go through my mind's eye of the, you know, Elizabeth was immensely cruel to the Catholics in Britain. Joan of Arc was, the women leaders tended to be extreme. Isabel
in Spain,
the Jews, just extreme. Mm-hmm. And then when a woman was in that situation, maybe out of overcompensation or something for the position,
or she's just filling the position.
Yeah, right.
Did you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to say, women, centuries have been relational, and in many places in this time are in war. I mean, Israel, both men and women have time to serve in war. And I think we are warlike in this nation, maybe not with weapons, but in other ways, because of our role not being able to go out and use a gun, but our warlike in the way we treat people and other ways, in relational ways, that whether it's bicultural or I'm not sure. But I don't know how in other nations, you know, in El Salvador and Nicaragua, the women are out there fighting along with the men. It'd be interesting to hear that perspective. how you perceive the women in roles, etc.
But don't you imagine that would be the same case here if the fighting were, you know, right at our front door?
Certainly it would.
Shipping us off.
Do you want to say anything, or and then maybe we should quit right after that, or?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of Nicaragua, women have traditionally not been combatants, even with mm-hmm. the Salen. In the case of El Salvador, there are women combatants, and they're very and they take leadership roles. They're very active in it. It's an interesting thing because there it's not so much a men-women issue, really. In terms of stating that this is a men's liberation or women's liberation issue, it's a human collective liberation. We all participate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the point in this text too, is the people were in danger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a superordinate goal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, my first. Yeah.